for ways that it can be dealt with. You're right about inspections. There is no question but that the inspectors found large numbers of chemical and biological weapons, and they found significant nuclear activities. It is also true that when they finished, they came up with a list of things that were unaccounted for, that they had every reason to believe existed, but they could not find, no matter how long they spent, years, and they tried. And it was a significant amount of chemical and biological capability they could not find. Now, the Iraqi nuclear program, which exists today, proceeded apace while the IAEC was actually doing their job. And it's a very difficult job to do because, as I said earlier, an inspection regime is designed to work with a cooperative country that's made a decision that they want to actually confess and have the things known, and they work with them. A good deal of what the inspectors found was not because the Iraqi regime was working with them. It was because defectors came outside the country and cued them as to places they could look. And, of course, a couple of the most important defectors who came outside the country were sons-in-laws who went back in the country and were later assassinated by Saddam Hussein. So it is no one ought to think that inspections don't have a role, and in my opening remarks I indicated I believe they do. The question is, under what circumstances, with what countries, and after what kind of a decade-long record ought one to put their faith in those? Now, is it conceivable that someone could, of course, the goal is not inspections, the goal, as you point out, is disarmament. And is it possible that you could have a sufficiently intrusive inspection approach that would enable you to disarm that country if the same regime was in there and was determined to try to prevent you from doing that? At that point, it's something other than inspectors. It is so intrusive and so powerful that it has the ability to enforce itself. And, of course, that kind of force people generally call something other than inspectors. But
I think it's important to note the inspectors, UNSCOM inspectors, not only discovered and uncovered, they did destroy what they came up with.
Exactly.
And No question about it.
As you know, the UNSCOM inspection regime is not what exists today. What exists today in UNMOVIC is a series of backtracking off of that because Saddam was saying, well, you can't go to, you can only inspect military installations. And that puts most of the country off base. You can't do that. And put in restrictions. You had to give notice. And furthermore, they've had another period of years to burrow under the ground. They now have massive tunneling systems. They have mobile biological capabilities. They've been developing unmanned aerial vehicles, which are worrisome. They've got all kinds of things that have happened in the period when the inspectors have been out. So the problem is greater today, and the regime that exists today in the UN is one that has far fewer teeth than the one you were describing.
Sure. Thanks, sir.
Thank the gentleman. Mr. Heffley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Secretary.
The committee's alternating between Republicans
and
Democrats.
This is Joel Heffley, Republican of Colorado. We know Saddam Hussein is a bad guy, a terrible guy, probably a psychopath. But I don't know that anyone has said he is stupid. Do you have any hope at all that if there is renewed pressure by the United States and the United Nations through resolutions or whatever, that the guy is going to say, it's been my sense that his bottom line is he wants to stay in power. He knows what we can do to him. Do you have any hope at all that he'll say, well, I got to take another course. If I'm going to stay in power, this isn't working.
as long as he has options, he will certainly take the best options he can find. And it seems to me that it's the task, and the president put it before the international community, that the task for the international community, if we want the United Nations to be relevant and their resolutions recognized as having some specific density, what we have to do is to demonstrate to that regime that they don't have a lot of options other than disarming. And, is it possible he could wake up one morning and decide he wants to go live with baby Doc Duvalier or Idi Amin Dada or one of the former dictators of the world in some country of choice? Who knows? He clearly won't do that of choice. And if his next best choice is to stay there and acquiesce in everything that's requested of him, he's certainly given no indication of that in his background. And you're quite right. He's not stupid. I've met him and talked to him and spent time with him. And he is a survivor. And he is a brutal, vicious dictator.
Would you comment, insofar as you can, in an open hearing, on the strength of the of their military at this point? I guess I have several concerns. Bill Clinton said the other night on the Letterman show that he thought a couple weeks of bombing and a week of ground forces and it'd be over. I don't know if we can be that optimistic. One of the things I have concern about is that if we attack him, he showed in the Persian Gulf War that he'll send missiles to Israel. If he sends dirty bombs to Israel, we know he has them. We know he has the capability of delivery. If he does that, I don't think we restrain Israel this time and they just back off and say, well, we'll take it. Maybe they will. And then what does that do to our situation there in the whole Middle East? Do we have the capability, do you think, of hitting him hard enough, fast enough, and in the right places to see that he's incapable of doing that kind of thing? How strong? I understand that the Republican Guards, that he fairly recently has purged their leadership, they're not too keen on him either, so that might not be a great strength for him this time. But we hear so many things, I don't know what's true and what's not.
Well, we have to begin questions like that, of course, with the fact that the president has made no recommendation at this stage with respect to using military force in Iraq. He has said what he said. There's no question but that Saddam Hussein's military capability today is less than it was during Desert Storm, and there's also no question but that the capability of the United States is considerably greater than it was during Desert Storm in terms of lethality. And there's also no question but that, as General Myers said, the United States is capable of doing those things that the country decides it like it would like it to do. With respect to Israel, there is no question but that Iraq's neighbors, were there to be a conflict, would have a degree of vulnerability. And there's also no question but that that would probably not last for a very long time, that they would be vulnerable. And there's also no doubt in my mind but that it would be in Israel's overwhelming best interest not to get involved. General Myers?
Congressman Heffley, let me just add a couple of things to that. His ground forces are roughly about half of what they were a decade ago. He's got 23 divisions today, of which six are Republican Guard. You never know for sure, but the reports are that the morale is low, particularly in the regular Army units, higher in the Republican Guard units, because the regime pays more attention to those units. He's got about 300 combat aircraft, of which less than half are mission-capable on any given day. And from what we can tell from reactions to some of our reconnaissance vehicles, not very tactically adept. In terms of the threat that the forces there would present to Israel, clearly that would be in the missile regime. And I, to to not address Mr. Congressman Spratt's comment on that, but to just make one little comment. I think we're much better today because of some of the things I said in my opening statement in terms of our command and control and communications, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. We'll be much more effective in thwarting that threat to Israel today.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Ortiz.
Thank you,
again,
Chairman.
Over to the Democrats.
I'd like to welcome the Secretaries and Gentlemen.
This is Solomon Ortiz of Texas.
We have huge responsibilities as we listen to all this testimony, whether it's classified or in open hearing. And as we listen to the experts, sometimes it gets to be a little confusing to try to sort out all this testimony. In my district, they quite often show me a statement that was made by General Zinni back in Florida when he was speaking to a group. When he said, most of us who have either fought in a war, have worn the uniform, do not want to go to war, but those that wear the civilian clothing are eager to go to war. I'm just wondering if there is something much deeper into this or information that we do not have. Because when we get that resolution, this is going to be very serious business when we vote on it. And I can remember when President Reagan was here and we decided to extend the time of the troops in Lebanon, I voted for it. And then we had 245 Marines who died. I mean, this is very, very serious business, and we're trying to be sure that whatever we do, that we make the right decision. Another thing that my constituents asked me, will this escalate? And for the first time, if we do that, if we attack Iraq, are we going to begin to see suicide bombers within the United States because we don't have the right intelligence? We know that there are cells in the United States, and this is the things that we have to sort out. I want to make the right decision, and I hope, Mr. Chairman, that we can ask the general, which I have a lot of respect for, to come and testify before this committee, because we have huge responsibilities. And maybe, Mr. Secretary, you can elaborate a little bit on this.
Yes, sir. It's an important question. And you can find generals and admirals on every side of these issues. You can find civilians on every side of these issues. Oversimplifying it, I think, is a disservice. And it seems to me that anyone with any sense at all would approach the subject of using military force with a great deal of caution, with a great deal of care to the things that can go wrong, and there are any number of things that can happen and go wrong. To go directly to your question, which was something like if we were to engage in a military effort in Iraq again, is it conceivable that that could stimulate terrorist attacks and suicide bombers and the like? I think we learned from September 11th that we don't have to go to war with Iraq to stimulate suicide bombers. They're already there. They attacked us. They killed over 3,000 people. And it wasn't because we went to war with Iraq. It was because they decided that that's what they wanted to do, and that there are thousands of those people that were trained in Afghanistan and other countries spread across this globe who were financed by, went to school on the inspectors. Did you? Yeah. And the longer they were there, the more they found how they worked and what they did, and developed the ability to use more underground, more tunneling, burying more weapons in different locations, using many, many multiple locations, hundreds, as opposed to one or two or three locations. And it is a moving target, I think it's safe to say. I should also add to Mr. Skelton, Congressman, I'm reminded that the Department of State has had a Future of Iraq project effort going forward, and they would be the department that obviously would be able to give you a greater granularity on that.
Could I just chime in a little bit, for Congressman Spratt? I'd like just to tag on to what the Secretary
General
said.
Myers.
I think another way of saying that is that Iraq over the last decade has become a master, the regime a master of deception. And as you said, they've gone underground, they've gone mobile, they combine their biological and chemical weapons production with legitimate facilities, making it very difficult to sort out one from the other because they can convert so quickly. I think we found out when we had UN inspectors over there that very often the inspectors would come up to the front door and out the back door went the evidence. We know that as well. So it's going to make this problem of discovery just very, very difficult. And
I simply want to make two points. One was that what they did accomplish shouldn't be the
minimum,
particularly in the early part of their efforts. It's substantial. And secondly, they need to be backed up if they're going to be put back there. And there might be some advantage to sending them back there robustly to try to ferret out, particularly the VX and the biologicals that we might see thrown against us if we later invade.
That's a fair comment. I mean, it is certain, those are issues one has to put on the balance. The potential advantages that you're characterizing, and they're not nothing. They are something that isn't trivial. And balance it against the attitude of the regime and the determination of the regime, which is for us to not have knowledge of what it is they're doing. If there's anything that's clear, that's it. And second, the fact that time is passing, and how much time, how many years does one want to allow to pass, given the progress that's being made with respect to their weapons programs?
I thank the gentleman and Ms. Secretary. We had the inspectors in front of us, and the essence of their testimony was
Mrs.
in the
Duncan
early
Hunter,
years
California.
When we had a virtual occupation of the country. They were acquiescent, and that's when we made the fairly major fines. But that in the later years, the only person there when they got to these facilities, the vast majority, was a piano player. There was nobody else there. And that they were met by the Iraqi bureaucracy at over 200 of these facilities with nothing inside. They were virtually hollow inspections. Nonetheless, I think this is an area that our members are very, very interested in. And the gentleman who spent a couple hundred hours on this issue, the fine gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Saxton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on the chairman's comments, Mr. Secretary, last week we hosted before the committee Dr. David Kaye, who is the former United Nations Chief Nuclear Weapons Inspector in Iraq, and Dr. Richard Spurzel, who was the former head of the biology section of the inspection team. And the message was unmistakably one of frustration, of inability to get the cooperation of the Iraqis, of experiences like being made to wait in parking lots for days and then to be turned away from a facility, and just a general notion that at least the inspection effort that was made in the 90s was unsuccessful to the point of finally being ejected from the country. So that is a frustration which we talked about at length with Dr. Kaye and Dr. Spurzel, and then asked them what it would take to be successful in a future effort at such an inspection, and they said that without the total cooperation of the Iraqi government, that it would be next to impossible to do, and with a team many times the size of the team that was previously in Iraq, with those two conditions, perhaps it could be successful. Now, I heard with everyone else, I observed the events of recent days when the Iraqi foreign minister wrote a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations. And forgive me for being skeptical, but I read this letter, and I'd just like to read the two, what I think are the operative paragraphs. Paragraph 2 says, "I am pleased to inform you to the Secretary of the decision of the government of the Republic of Iraq to allow the return of United Nations weapons inspectors to Iraq without conditions. And then several paragraphs later, it says, to this end, the government of the Republic of Iraq is ready to discuss the practical arrangements necessary. I guess this is kind of symptomatic of the problem. The problem is, in one paragraph we use the words without conditions, and in several paragraphs later we have to talk about the arrangements. So I guess I'm asking you for your take on this. Is this the same kind of thing that we ran into in the last inspection effort already in the invitation to come?
Well, I asked Secretary Powell about that, who's been dealing, of course, with the United Nations about it, and I asked him this morning, and his view was that it is very obviously a tactical step on their part and not a straightforward, without conditions approach.
Well, thank you for that. I wanted to just verify that I was reading the words and interpreting them as you did. Let me ask another question. Going back years, we know that the Soviet Union was successful in developing a whole array of weaponized diseases known as biological weapons. They ranged from anthrax and smallpox, which are familiar terms to us, to the weaponization of plague and tularemia and Marlboro and many other diseases. Do we know to what extent the Iraqis have been able to borrow technology from others, perhaps including the Soviet Union, or the Russians today, or others, former Soviet states? And to what extent is this program developed in Iraq?
That really is a subject I'd prefer to have asked of the intelligence community and in closed session. But I can say, obviously, that they have had an enormous appetite for weapons, biological weapons and chemical weapons. They've taken these capabilities and weaponized them. They are continuing to do so today. They are looking not only at a variety of biological capabilities, but at a variety of ways of dispensing or weaponizing them so that they have a range of choices with respect to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank the gentleman. The gentleman from Mississippi, Mr. Taylor.
This is Jean Taylor, Democrat of Mississippi.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Secretary General Myers. Mr. Secretary, there's not a single thing that you said today that I disagree with. In fact, I think based on history and the element of surprise that was attained first by the Israelis in 67 and then by the Egyptians and the Arabs in 73, I would even add the element that since we as a nation are talking about going to war, and it's obviously being carried on a daily basis on all the cable networks, that we as a nation should not rule out a preemptive strike on the part of the Iraqis, particularly an act of terror against our citizens, for all the reasons that you outlined. To quote you, we should anticipate vastly more lethal attacks before they happen. With that in mind, there's two questions that I would like to hear you address. Number one, half of our forces in the Guard and Reserve. For the Gulf War, one of the things then President Bush, did correctly was almost an total mobilization of the Guard and Reserve for the military factors that were involved, and also because, in my opinion, it made it clear to the American people that this is everybody's war. It's not the poor draftee from across town like Vietnam. It's everybody's war. And I happened to, having served in Congress and saw the mood shift of the American people, that's when the signs went up in front of the city halls and the county courthouses, the fallen people from Bay St. Louis, fallen people from Waveland, proudly serving in the Gulf War. I think if we are talking of war, I think there has to be a mobilization of the Guard and Reserve prior to that vote, because we had best expect the Iraqis to act either prior to that vote or immediately after that vote. Second thing, Mr. Secretary, I just had a conversation with one of the senior chiefs from the New Orleans Fire Department New Orleans, by southern regions, is a huge city. And yet that huge city, by southern standards, has only 18 people trained in chemical and hazardous material. I'm talking about a huge city by southern standards. One of the things that this House voted very strongly on in just the past couple of weeks was the desire to have a weapons of mass destruction civil support team in every state. We now have, I believe, only 30 in the process of 30. It is my understanding that you're...
If you'll suspend for a minute, Mr. Taylor, we'll accommodate your question here. Let me just let my colleagues know we've got a vote coming up, but we intend to continue the hearing through the vote. And Mr. Heffley, if you could go vote early, perhaps, and come on back, we'll continue to hold the hearing, so we'll have some continuity. And I believe it's only one vote. If the staff correct me if I'm wrong, but, go ahead, Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Secretary, it is my understanding that the House voted by almost unanimously to have a weapons of mass destruction civil support team in the National Guard in every state to be the first responders, to have the training and the equipment to help out what are, in many instances, volunteer fire departments, is in an almost every instance underfunded fire and police departments to respond to what we know is eventually going to happen, just as you laid out very well. My question to you is, sir, why is your legislative shop over on the Senate side telling them that we don't need one of these in every state? And this comes from conversations that we've had with Senator Levin staff and others.
Two comments on your questions and your statements. My understanding is that a study was made and a number of these ChemBio elements units that were needed was calculated, and it was something less than 50. It was something less than one for each state. And it was based not on historical state lines, but it was based on population centers and geography and the ability to move these things and around where needed. The counter to that was that some people said, well, every state ought to have one. And they did not have a similar study that said that the additional cost would provide a benefit that merited that cost. And when one is looking at the difference between shipbuilding and the difference between chem bio units and anti-terrorists and force protection and all of those things, they tend to make calculations about where those funds can be best invested. Now, that is not to say that any state can't have one themselves if they want one themselves. They can do it. But at the moment, in terms of priorities, the plan, the study that went forward, I'm advised, reflected the best judgment of the people who understand these things as to how the coverage of our country could be best employed. Second, with respect to reserve forces and guard, you're quite right. They represent an enormous fraction of our total capability. And you're also quite right that they were activated in large numbers in the Gulf War. Clearly, all the discussion about the president coming to the Congress and seeking a resolution, the president going to the United Nations and helping them understand the circumstance, the security circumstance we're in, takes away any strategic surprise for Saddam Hussein. He is going to be watching what happens and making his calculations and his judgments. That does not mean that you've lost all tactical surprise, but you certainly have lost strategic surprise, so to speak. I disagree completely that there should be a complete activation prior to a vote in the Congress. I mean, we already have 70,000 reserves activated, and we already have 20,000-plus people on stop losses who are not leaving the service, and we've got a very sizable force, and there's no question but that we would have to activate reserves for various functions and guard, depending on what decisions are made. But I think it would be a fundamental mistake to think that it had to precede some kind of a vote.
Mr. Secretary, if I could, you made allusion to the dark winter scenario study done by Senator Nunn and others. One of the things it talked about was simultaneously biological attacks on a number of cities. Mm-hmm. One of the things that my friend from New Jersey has pointed out is recently, September 11th of last year, when the attacks occurred in New York, in his home state of New Jersey, asked for one of those weapons of mass destruction teams from other states to participate, the answer from the governors was no, we're going to take care of our own. As you so correctly pointed out, do we have to wait to be burned before we address this? Even if we start today, those teams aren't ramped up for at least 18 months to 2 years. But a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. We have to start now. Mm-hmm. If you really believe that the Iraqis possess these weapons of mass destruction and have the intention to use them, why do we delay a single day in ramping up these teams so that every state has some degree of protection and every state has some degree of training? And we know that the responders don't themselves die when they go to find out what happened. At least they have the equipment. Because I think it's safe to say that if there are only 18 Chembio suits in the city of New Orleans, I doubt there are 18 Chembio suits in the entire state of Mississippi.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but is this a Department of Defense controlled matter, or is it Homeland Security? I just don't know.
I think there are pieces in both places, and as I, the only thing I recall is that for first responders, I think as Governor Ridge has said, first responders should be the civilians, and then we fold in where they cannot handle the task, and that's, I think that is the policy.
General, with all due respect, this is an attack on the American people. It's not a flood. It's not a tornado. Second thing is the cities are not equipped for this. The city of New Orleans has over 1 million people. They've got 18 hazardous material suits and the people who know how to respond to this. 18 out of 1 million. And they're better prepared than most cities in the South. This is a national defense priority, and I would certainly hope that y'all would make it a national defense priority, and let's not wait to be burned before we respond to it.
I think, Congressman, one of the things that the department has done that's going to be really important in this area is to stand up that the new Northern Command, because that's exactly one of the things they've got to.
My father had a couple of sayings. One was, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. That's a popular one. I'm not sure what the hell fool me 16 times means. And I hope we don't find out what fool me 17 times means. The other saying he had, and he would use it towards Saddam Hussein if he were still with us, people like that have a motto, play ball with me, and I'll stick the bat up your nose. You wouldn't say nose, but I will clean that up. It just seems to me that, as I mentioned, the options are becoming less. But let me get off the editorial comment and go to a question. I'd be interested, either Mr. Secretary or General Myers, to the extent you can tell us. In Afghanistan, obviously, we had a very active surrogate army, the Northern Alliance, involved there. There's been a lot of discussion about the dissident groups, whether they get along or do not get along, the Kurds, the Shiites, et cetera, in Iraq. To what extent would our military action, if it comes about, be predicated upon their involvement, reliant upon their advancement as it was in Afghanistan?
Well, let me start by saying that the Iraqi people are repressed and are being subjugated by that regime. There is no doubt in my mind, but the overwhelming majority are anxious to be liberated and be free of that regime. There are Iraqis inside that country by the thousands who feel that way. There are Iraqis outside that country by the thousands who feel that way. There are people in Iraq today who clearly would be helpful, not as well organized in many instances as in the case in Afghanistan, and there are people outside the country who are anxious to be helpful. I'd prefer not to get into numbers, and it would be a notably different situation than Afghanistan. But there's no question but that there would be Iraqis who would be helping to liberate their own country.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Abercrombie?
Yes, just a follow-up. General Myers, I want to make sure that I understand, because this is for the
Neil
record.
Abercrombie,
you actually
Abercrombie
is contending that this Northern Command is going to take over the responsibility for the nation with respect to terrorist attacks in local communities and first response, that they will have that authority?
No, absolutely not. That's not what I intended at all. I just said that the roles of the Department of Defense do not change with the stand-up of Northern Command. But for once, we'll have a command with a commander that will worry about the planning and training for support to lead federal agencies or civil agencies or state agencies in responding to disasters, be they natural or be they terrorist disasters. And that's all I said. I said we'll have a command that will be helped to help find the balance that Congressman Taylor was talking about.
Well, how is that going to be any different from what's required by the Joint Forces Command right now, other than the fact that you're going to spend $300 million to put it together just to get started so it can start worrying?
I think it's having one person in charge of it. Right now in the Department of Defense, you have several people in charge of this. And I think putting one person that says, that's my job, is to protect the American people.
You're answering my question by saying that person's going to be in charge. Are they or are they not? The question here is the practical realities involved. Is the Department of Defense going to participate in some way other than consulting? Is the Northern Command supposed to consult with the 50 states who are already on their way to doing this? The president has already said, or is in the process, or has vetoed the supplemental bill that we put forward to try and fund some of these things. Now, you've got to make a decision. I don't think you need this Northern Command. I'd like to see the $300 million go into financing what Representative Taylor was talking about so responders can do this under the National Guard all across the country. How is the setup of the Northern Command supposed to aid and assist in one iota what Representative Taylor was putting forward?
I'll go back to my original comments, Congressman. Right now, in the Department of Defense, there are several entities that are responsible for whatever it is the Department of Defense is going to be asked to do to respond to either, as I said, natural disasters or chemical or biological or nuclear attack. What we want to do, and we have one entity then that's responsible for their defense, what we want to do is put that responsibility under one command. We think the situation has changed sufficiently. The strategic environment has changed sufficiently, not just since September 11th. This is an issue that goes back, as you remember, Congressman, this
is... Are the local forces to be in charge, General, or is the Northern Command supposed to be in charge of I guess, national civil defense?
As I said, the roles of the Department of Defense will not change. In most cases, will be in support of lead federal agencies or other civil agencies, be they state or even more local.
So the Department of Defense does not intend to fund in any way, shape, or form all of these requirements at the local level?
I don't know what requirements you're talking about.
Okay. You know, the requirements we're talking about is to be able to respond to a terrorist attack, which you contend has to have a Northern Command in order to respond.
Well, the department's certainly going to fund the part of that that are the responsibility of the department. And
it will fund the Northern Command so that you will have this gigantic new bureaucracy set up, initially drawing on apparently overstaffed other commands, because that's where you're getting the people from. So all the commands now must be overstaffed because you're able to bring in apparently hundreds of people.
Congressman, when we stand this new Northern Command up, I may have to correct this for record. My recollection is it'll be the smallest combatant command that we have in the United States Armed Forces. It'll be the smallest. We are, as you said, we are not adding people to this. We are taking people from other staff reductions that have been mandated by Congress, by the way. That 15% cut, we're going to take manpower from those positions and put some of those, not all of them, of course, but some of those in this new Northern Command headquarters.
And what are they going to do?
Let me leap in here, if I may, Mr. Congressman.
By all means, Mr. Secretary.
This is the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld.
The Unified Command Plan allocates responsibilities throughout the world. Heretofore, we have not had certain portions of the world covered by a unified or specified commander. They included Russia, the United States, Mexico, Canada, and some other portions, water portions of the world. As we proceeded, we decided that given the changes in the world, we should allocate every portion of the globe to a commander and a command. The cost for this command is going to come out of other commands. And the idea that it's going to be $300 million and a bunch of people milling around wasting money is just not going to be the case. Second.
Despite the fact, excuse me, Mr. Secretary, that that's the way it's proposed right now in the Joint Forces Command budget.
What I said is correct. The role of the Department of Defense will not change with respect to the United States of America in this important sense. We're not asking that Posse Comitatus be changed. We're not suggesting that we go into a role where we're the principal and other state, federal, local agencies support us. We would be functioning, as we have in the past, in a supporting role. The general was exactly correct when he said that at the present time, we've got NORAD that functions in a supporting role to some extent. We've got DOMS. The Army manages a whole host of things. We had 5,000 or 6,000 people at Salt Lake City for the Olympics.
All of which exist, Mr. Secretary, without a Northern Command and apparently function very well, unless you're saying that they have not done a good job to this point. See, what I'm trying to say, Mr. Secretary, is actually we're doing a good job. And I can tell you Hawaii is only one part of the 50-state picture, which is doing an excellent job of preparing for this. And they have excellent relationships, like with General Smith in the 25th out in Hawaii. The Department of Defense is very well represented, and the coordination is already there. What they need is support. And they don't need another command to come in on top of this. And the question has yet to be answered whether this Northern Command will in any way, shape, or form support what is already being accomplished in all of 50 states. How is it to support it other than by standing there nodding its head?
I guess I don't know what you mean by you say how will it support all the things that are already being done so well by the 50 states. Any state can do what it wants. Any city can do what it wants. They can have their fire department. They can have Cambio outfits.
How are they going to pay for what is required of them under the kinds of scenarios that you are outlining
who pays
likely to occur if we go to war with Iraq?
Who pays is a function of what the Congress and the executive branch decide. Whether it's a federal responsibility, if so, which department or agency, which state or local governments have to do what, that's a mix that the Congress and the executive branch sorts out every year as they make their decisions.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Mr. Thornberry.
Mr. Heffley of Colorado is back in the chair, substituting.
Let me,
there are only about a dozen members of Congress here. Most of them have gone to vote.
Statement that effectively
and
deals with
the,
a lot of
the Republican who is speaking now is Mac Thornberry of Texas.
Swirling around there. As you were talking, I was reminded of a storyline in a television program. I don't even know if it's still on, but the main character would get a newspaper delivered to his door at the beginning of the program. And in that newspaper, it would have a story of a tragedy which was going to occur 2 or 3 days later. And the character's job was try to prevent the tragedy before the newspaper became reality. It seems to me that's kind of where we are. We know the end of the story. We know the tragedy if we do nothing. The question is how, when we prevent it from occurring. I guess the primary question on my mind, and General Myers, I may direct this to you, is if the President decides to take military action in Iraq, are we ready? And in particular, are we ready to have forces in an environment where weapons of mass destruction may be used against them? Maybe not initially, but eventually, if things all fall apart, as we think they will for that regime, desperate people use desperate measures. I'm concerned we have not given adequate consideration to our troops dealing in that environment for the last decade, not under your watch. But I guess I would ask you, are we ready to deal with that environment and to do what the President orders you to do?
Congressman Thornberry, let me Let me first say that the short answer is yes. The longer answer is over the past decade, and I would admit early in the decade, our capability to deal with weapons of mass destruction for our soldiers and sailors and airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, was uneven. But in the last part of this decade, for the majority of it, we have made very good improvements in terms of sensors that detect attacks, in terms of being able to net those sensors together to provide, you know, area warning for collective protection, and in the kind of protective suits that our troops wear. So we've made improvements in all those areas. And without getting into much more detail, obviously our forces prepare for that, they train for that, and would be ready to deal with that type of environment.
Let me ask you one other question, which goes to the issue of can we do both, or the existing war on terrorism as well as this other aspect of the war on terrorism. There are reports today that the command for the existing war on terrorism may be shifting to the special operations folks. Are you able to comment on that? Is that happening, and if so, why, and what you hope to gain by it?
Let me take that.
Addressing that to me?
Whoever wants to.
I think what is being reflected in the paper, and I haven't read the article. I read
this
the headline and
General
maybe
Myers.
A couple of paragraphs. Is the fact that, and the realization, of course, that this is a global war on terrorism, and the combatant commanders, as they're organized today, most of them, the theater ones, are organized on a regional basis. We have some that cross regional boundaries: U.S. Space Command, U.S. Transportation Command. The current strategic command and the new strategic command that is proposed to stand up or will stand up here on 1 October. Another one of those commands that can look globally is Special Operations Command. It has a global view of things. And for some aspects of the war on terrorism, it's useful to have that global view. And without getting into the operational details of that, that's, I think, what we're seeing. I don't know that this reflects a great change in our strategy. And there's some elements, and I haven't read the article, but there's some elements that have not been finally decided yet that the Secretary and the rest of the National Security Council will have to decide on. But what we're trying to do is ensure that in a global war, we have the kind of view, in some cases a global view is required, because these networks, I mean, they don't respect any boundaries, and as we know, they're in over 60 countries. It is absolutely a network, and it has to be addressed kind of in its total.